Order. The first item we'll hear today is a public hearing on House Bill 2022, creates a crime of hindering assistance animal in the second degree. And if I could have Melinda Carlson, Patricia Kepler up, please. And Ms. Mullen, if you could give us a brief description, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2022 is here at the request of the Committee on Human Services for the Guide Dog Users of Oregon. It would, as you stated already, Mr. Chair, create the crime of hindering an assistance animal in the second degree. It also creates the crime of hindering an assistance animal in the first degree, making those the first degree would be a Class C felony and the second degree would be a Class A misdemeanor. It also would expand the crime of animal abuse in the first degree to include certain actions relating to assistance animals. It makes technical changes to some existing law based on the creation of the crimes of hindering the assistance animal. And finally, it modifies grounds for the civil cause of action for damages arising from acts involving assistance animals, and classifies dogs that injure or disable or cause the death of an assistance animal as a public nuisance.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Either one, go ahead, whoever would like to go first. And just please introduce yourself by name for the record.
Why don't you go ahead and go first? Okay. My name is Patricia Kepler. I live in Aloha. And I'm here to speak or to testify for House Bill 2022. 2 years ago, I came to Salem and talked with the Senate about my five-year-old guide, then Chance, who had been repeatedly harassed by a neighbor's dog who was habitually allowed to run loose. I told them then that it was most likely Chance would be retired, and he was, because of the effects that the dog left on him. He was no longer able to concentrate on guiding me. He was more concerned about what other dogs were doing. So a very short career for a dog that guided me across the country and without ever failing me. I ultimately failed him because I was unable to protect him. I now have a two-year-old guide that I've recently received, and I'm no longer able to safely travel through my own neighborhood. I can't walk to my bus stop. I can't walk to a grocery store because the same dog is still running loose, terrorizing the neighborhood. And so far, animal control and the sheriff have been unable to help me deal with them because of the way the current law is written. So, as well as, you know, releasing my own freedoms, I'm an additional burden on TriMet. I have to take paratransit rather than fixed route buses because I can't walk safely to a bus stop. And my story isn't unique. It's happening throughout the state. There are careless pet owners allowing their dogs to run free and harass our dogs, and there is no consequence. This current bill would allow us to regain some justice on behalf of our dogs and send a message to these careless pet owners that owning a dog is a responsibility, and allowing it to run free and causing harm to others is just not acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you. Might I ask, the Washington County Dog Control, they're not able to give you any apparently not able to give you any assistance on that?
They weren't able to. I've been on the phone with them repeatedly over this issue. They were at one point, after repeated communications, they were able to, I think they did give an at-large dog citation to them. They were trying to get the sheriff to use the current law to that's in place for guide dogs as a penalty against the family who owns the dog, and the sheriff was passing it back to animal control and saying they couldn't do anything. So it went back and forth for some time, and then animal control did finally cite them for having that large dog.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Please.
Hi, my name's Melinda Carlson, and I work at Guide Dogs for the Blind in Boring, Oregon. And my job is to provide support services to the 150-plus guide dog graduates that live in the state of Oregon. And I'm really sad to say that there's an increasing number of dog attacks as well as negative dog encounters happening. And I concur with Patricia that this is happening for numerous reasons. Dog control, obviously, is not as well-funded as it used to be, so it's really hard to get people to follow up when our clients are calling and in an emergency right at that time. Police are not responding. animal control folks, you know, would like to help but just don't have the time. Another problem is the clients that I work with are visually impaired. However, this bill hopefully covers any person with a disability with a service animal. But visually impaired people can't identify the dog. So if the dog control people can't come right at that time and the blind person can't describe the dog, then nothing gets followed up on. Dog bites with people are now epidemic, according to the Center for Disease Control. Nobody's monitoring the dog-to-dog bites, and so we really don't have any inkling of how it's increasing other than all the phone calls that I get from people saying, you know, my dog was attacked again. And one of the problems is that we've always measured a dog attack by the medical and physical trauma caused, but these guide dogs, oftentimes it's the mental trauma, which is kind of what Patricia was describing. And they need to be confident in their environment, but not aggressive. So if they're being harassed, oftentimes these very nice, sensitive, manageable dogs are no longer able to travel through their environment. So anyway, I'm really hoping that this can help all the folks out there traveling with service animals that have disabilities that aren't able to access their own community. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the panel? Okay, thank you very much.
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I guess I'll put a question to Ms. Carlson. To what extent are the concerns arising from animal attacks or disruption as opposed to human on animal disruption?
You know, what I'm dealing with is primarily animal on animal attacks. It's interesting because if someone's walking down the street with I'm going to speak to dogs because that's what I do for a living. I'd say that 99% of the time the attack is going to be on that dog as opposed to on the animal. There is the rare situation where a person's bit, and then, of course, all the laws kick in. You know, if it's an animal bite and it draws blood, then the dog has to be quarantined. And am I answering your question?
You probably are, but I'm not quite grasping
okay.
The answer. The question that I had was posing is, okay, we have an assistance animal who's in a public place, and there's an attack or some event that occurs to that assistance animal. In what proportion of the problem cases is that an animal who's doing another dog, as opposed to a human being who's doing something to the assistance animal?
Typically, I would say it is an animal that's doing the attacking. Sometimes it's the irresponsible pet owner that might be, you know, there are a few folks that might harass verbally or make comments, but I think that primarily we're talking about irresponsible pet owners whose dogs might be loose, like the one Patricia's talking about, or oftentimes it's just pet dog owners whose dogs are on leashes and they have no control over their dogs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ms. Sky, next, please.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And first of all, I'd like to say that we don't oppose the idea of a new offense of hindering an assistance animal. But the way that the bill is currently drafted, we believe, is too broad. And that is for three reasons. The first reason can be found in line 16, and that prescribes the mental state for this crime, and that is criminal negligence. I think that you're all aware that we have a number of different criminal states in criminal law. There's intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and the lowest is criminal negligence. It's a state of mind that's not used very much in criminal law, I think, for two reasons. One, it's difficult to prove, and because it's very close to just regular negligence, which would be, you know, making a mistake. You make a mistake in your car and you hit somebody else. That's not a crime, but you can be sued civilly and required to pay. Criminal negligence is slightly above that, and all it requires is proof that there a substantial risk of harm or that a certain result would occur and that the person who is acting was unaware of that substantial risk that they should have been aware of. So you can see how that's somewhat confusing. Reckless behavior, which is a more commonly used state of mind in criminal law, is being aware of a substantial risk but disregarding it. So frequently we see these in where a person is drinking and driving and speeding. They're aware that there's a substantial risk they could hurt somebody, but they disregard it and they act anyway. Our concern is that criminal negligence is just such a low standard of proof. It's not used very often in the criminal code, and I would say that in order to be punishable as a crime, this mental state should be changed to at the least reckless or knowing behavior. The second concern can then be found in line 17. This lays out exactly what the crime or what the offense is. Without provocation, injures, attempts to injure, disables, attempts to disable. Those are all things that that a person would have to actively do. The third is interferes with the work or jeopardizes the safety. It's the word interferes that's concerning because, as you can imagine, it probably doesn't take a lot to interfere with the work of an assistance animal. Pairing that with criminal negligence, you can see how it would be difficult to prosecute, difficult to prove, difficult to defend, and may cover more behavior than is necessary under this bill. And similarly, in subsection B, which starts on line 20, which actually I think addresses the situations that the proponents were talking about, and that's where the keeper of another dog fails to keep that dog from injuring, attempting to injure, disabling, or attempting to disable, or again, the word interfering with the work. Now, interfering, again, we are concerned may be too broad. There certainly are a lot of situations where a dog can be interfered with that the owner, maybe isn't under criminal negligence aware of the substantial risk and disregarding it, which would make them guilty. So those are our concerns. The other thing that I wanted to bring to the committee's attention is that Senator Deckert worked very hard on a bill dealing with dog control, and there was a work group involving Senator Whitsitt, who was a veterinarian, and it was dealing specifically with the problem of dogs running around the neighborhood, attacking children, attacking other dogs, and updating our law to address those dogs, and that may also help the situations that are described by the proponent.
Hey, are there any questions?
You wouldn't happen to know the relating clause of Senator Deckert's bill, would you?
No.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. We're going to process this a little bit further. I'm going to look in to see if we can't fit this into the Senate bill that Senator Deckert has. And if not, we'll try to work on a fix so that this gets at what Ms. Kepler has asked for on that. And that's to protect the assistance animals that are from these attacks and so on. So we're going to work on this. We'll try and bring it back in a piece of legislation we feel has a chance of getting through. So the way this is right now would have a great deal of difficulty. I don't believe we could pass it out, but we'll work on it. I'll have Ms. Moore keep in contact, and we'll see if we can't get something worked on that. And with that, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2022. If anybody's here, I have an announcement. If anybody's here on House Bill 3011, that's going to have to be reset to next Tuesday on the 10th of May so that amendments can be worked, so that's ready to go. Do you want to have a phone number or anything?
That's fine. Yeah, I'll take it.
She ran against the clock. Thank you.
Well, you can, why don't you do the public hearing and work session?
Okay.
Which is 3037.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 3037 by Steve Dole, Ms. Atura, and Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3037 would fill a gap in the aggravated murder statutes. In 2000, the Oregon Court of Appeals held in State versus Thompson that if a individual was to be a witness in a juvenile proceeding, their murder could not be aggravated murder because a juvenile proceeding is not a criminal proceeding, and it is already an aggravated murder if an individual, if a victim of murder is a witness in a criminal proceeding. So the issue is whether or not the juvenile delinquency proceeding would count.
Thank you. Let's see if we have Mr. Dole, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm with Crime Victims United of Oregon. Crime Victims United brings forward House Bill 3037 in hopes of correcting what we think was a bad opinion, if you will, by the appellate courts. Prior to the year 2000, if you witnessed a crime, no matter if the person who was perpetrating the crime was 13, 23, or 53, you were murdered as a result of witnessing that crime and coming forth, you were eligible to be charged with aggravated murder, which carried the death penalty, life without the possibility of parole, or life with the possibility of parole after 30 years. With this court decision, it now says that if you witness, for instance, a juvenile holding up a 7-Eleven store with a Glock, and you come forward in that case and you're murdered by the, say, the parent of that juvenile, that you cannot be charged with aggravated murder. You can be charged just with what we call intentional murder in the state of Oregon, which under Measure 11 carries 25 years, but prior to Measure 11 would carry only about 8 years. We don't think that this is equal justice. We don't think it's equal protection either for victims, law-abiding citizens, or the criminal. We believe that it's word splicing by the courts between criminal proceedings and juvenile adjudications. We believe that it's just another subtle response by this court, who is, we believe, to be anti-death penalty. They passed a... they had an opinion that came out the same year in the case of young Christina Hornich, who was murdered by Scott Harberts, which again was just a technicality. I mean, there's nobody on death row in Oregon, to our knowledge, that's screaming that they are innocent. These are all technical issues, and our history of the death penalty in this state is basically two volunteers and one guilty man walking, and that guilty man is Scott Harberts. I only bring this forward because we did make a change in the death penalty based on that case, and it became the Christina Hornich law. And hopefully we can do the same thing with this situation, and it will turn into the Aaron Itura law. And we have Ms. Itura here today to tell you specifically about the case that brought this situation about. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Ms. Itura?
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Janice Itura, and I also am a member of Crime Victims United and Parents of Murdered Children. In September of 1994, my son, Aaron Itura, was a witness of a knife assault by another juvenile. Aaron made the decision to step up and agree to testify against that juvenile offender, Bo Flynn, in the juvenile court in October 5, 1994. Everything changed when the mother of that juvenile, Mary Thompson, decided to take the matter into her own hands and ordered the shooting death of my son, Aaron, to keep him from testifying. On October 3rd, at 1:45 a.m. in the morning, two juveniles broke into my home and shot my son in the back of the head while he was sleeping. At 10:45 a.m. that morning, Aaron was pronounced dead. Joseph Brown and Jim Elstead were ordered by Mary Thompson, known as the Gang Mom, to execute my son to prevent him from testifying. Brown received 10 years for murder, Elsted received 16 years for murder, and Mary Thompson received a conviction for aggravated murder, receiving life without any chance of parole, the aggravating factor being the murder of a witness in a trial. In April of 2000, the Oregon Courts of Appeal overturned Mary Thompson's conviction for aggravated murder on the grounds of a juvenile court proceeding in which Aaron was to testify did not qualify as a criminal proceeding because of the juvenile court, not adult court. The law on aggravated murder, statute 163.95, says that the murder is aggravated if the victim was one of the following and a murder was related to the performance of a victim's official duty in the justice system, a juror, or a witness in a criminal proceeding. In December of 2000, Mary Thompson was resentenced to murder rather than aggravated murder. Her sentence reduced to 25 years. Then she became eligible for the 20% earned time reduction, only 25 years less earned time, for the execution style of my son, Aaron Itura, instead of life for aggravated murder, just because it was a juvenile proceeding. I would like you to imagine for a moment that an adult murderer murdered one of the members of your family, possibly your mother, because she was a witness in a criminal trial to keep her from testifying. The murderer was found guilty of aggravated murder. And then I'd like you to imagine for a moment that your sister is murdered to keep her from testifying only at the time of a juvenile trial. The murderer can only be found guilty of murder, not aggravated murder. Both were stepping up and doing the right thing, just as my son Aaron did. But you must understand that they are all just as dead. Aaron got the death penalty, and my family and I, we were sentenced to life without Aaron. I believe anyone who orders the murder of a witness at any level of legal court proceedings, whether it be juvenile, civil, or criminal, should be eligible under the aggravated murder statute. On October 3rd, 1994, my family and I began a life of consisting of fear and grief. Little did I know that my nightmare in 1994 was about to begin all over again. Joseph Brown was released from prison January 18, 2004. Now I have learned that the shooter, Jim Elsted, is scheduled to be released in 2008. Bo Flynn, 2009. I have been informed that with earned time that they could be released as soon as 2006. Mary Thompson's scheduled release date is February 9th, 2021, or possibly sooner. I have been informed that Mary Louise Thompson has filed a post-conviction relief, which is scheduled to be heard June 14th, 2005, just in a couple months. My current fear is that these three gang members will be released into the same county, Lane, community that their families still live in the same houses, in the same neighborhood as I do. Joseph Brown has already made verbal threats, which have been reported to the Oregon Board of Corrections, of Parole, by Brown's own family and myself. I believe that there's only a matter of time before the gang members reunite. I have fears particularly for my surviving children, and I wonder if my nightmare has really only just begun. Please fix this loophole that Mary Thompson was escaped through and don't allow this to happen to another family. This House bill is supported by Crime Victims United and the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I'm asking you to please pass 3037. And thank you for this opportunity, and I'm more than willing to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much for again coming in. Telling your story.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Mr. McDonald?
Members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney for Multnomah County. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We ask you to pass this bill. We do not view it as an expansion of the death penalty, only as an attempt to correct either inadvertence or what was originally intended when this provision of the aggravating factor of the death penalty was adopted. In any event, it seems like it's only reasonable to provide symmetry to the system that witnesses in juvenile proceedings should provide the same protections as witnesses in adult proceedings.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Anybody? Thank you. Kelly Sky, Mr. Castagna, and Ms. Pugh. Versus. Thank you.
Kelly Sky, Legislative Representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose House Bill 3037 because it is an expansion of the aggravated murder statute, and we're opposed to capital punishment, and we're opposed to any expansion of the provisions. There are already 19 separate provisions, ways that you can commit the crime of aggravated murder, and we believe that expansion is not a good idea. Every session, we could probably have a case come down before the legislature. Somebody who people believe should have been eligible for the death penalty but wasn't. And I would urge this committee to resist expanding on the basis of individual cases. Further, it's important to keep in mind that the death penalty is probably one of the most costly provisions in our criminal justice system. It's costly, and we don't actually get the results out of it that some may assume they would get. We have people on death row. We're not executing people. We're spending a lot of money prosecuting and defending these cases and incarcerating people. So the other thing to keep in mind is that the offense of murder has a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years. The maximum sentence is life. So once a person serves their mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years, then it becomes up to the parole board to decide when that person is released. And they don't necessarily need to be released at 25. The parole board could keep them for life.
Okay. Would you still be opposed to it if this removed the death penalty and just called for true life?
Much less opposed.
Thank you. Anybody else have a question? Thank you.
I'm Kathleen Pugh from Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty oppose House Bill 3037 because of its expansion of the definition of aggravated murder and therefore use of the death penalty. Our members work to increase the effectiveness of Oregon's response to violent interpersonal crime. We include survivors of victims, religious leaders, and other concerned citizens. In Oregon, we have adequate law for the purpose of punishing those who murder. We oppose defining categories of valued individuals as this statute does. Defining categories of valued individuals explicitly states that some lives are less valuable than others. Fewer than 1% of the murders eligible for the death penalty in the United States are actually executed. If the death penalty is the definition of justice for a victim's family, then 99% of all families do not get justice. Rather, family and friends adjust their bereavement, as do the survivors of victims in our group, without continuing the cycle of violence. Even if the committee votes to add a category to attempt to even out the value of witnesses in different proceedings, the family is still not guaranteed that the district attorney in a county where a similar murder occurs will ask for the death penalty. The death penalty will continue to be unevenly applied from county to county in Oregon. The family is also not guaranteed that some of the guilty will not make a deal with the district attorney. One death penalty eventually takes one life and creates new survivors, those of the executed person's family and friends. It does not deter the next murder, and therefore it doesn't increase public safety. It does not bring closure to the family. It does siphon off valuable resources from effective programs in crime prevention and public safety. Those are the only real protections that Oregonians deserve. With limited resources, legislators and the public need to be looking for and supporting the most effective public policy. House Bill 3037 is not in that category. Thank you.
Any questions? And would you be able to support the bill if the death penalty was off the table?
The only position that our group takes is whether the death penalty is used, so I can't speak for them at this time.
Okay, and then you mentioned that the idea of some people having a lesser value. How about the victim, where because Ms. Atura's son saw a juvenile commit a crime rather than an adult, so that the penalty is lesser because of that. Does that make the victim a lesser person?
Certainly not. I mean, her son was a very valuable person. I'm sure not only to her, but because he was a human being.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference represents the Catholic bishops of Oregon in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians in support of the common good for all. Now, the Oregon Catholic Conference today is here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3037 as an expansion of the death penalty. The conference bases its public policy positions on a consistent ethic of life approach. And the consistent ethic of life has as its central value the dignity and sanctity of all human life across the spectrum of issues from conception until natural death. We submitted testimony in the bill you had before you earlier, House Bill 2020, saying we could not support 2020, even though there is protection for the unborn victims of violence provisions because of the inclusion of the death penalty. So it comes as no surprise then to people who have been around the legislative halls that the Oregon Catholic Conference would oppose House Bill 3037 this session, as we have opposed similar bills in previous sessions that sought to expand the death penalty, particularly under this type of factual circumstance. That is not to say that our sympathies and condolences are not with the family who experienced the tragic loss as a result of this heinous crime. But we don't believe it takes society in a better direction, down a better path, to expand the death penalty. As a matter of fact, the U.S. Catholic bishops have opposed the death penalty for the past 25 years. And on March 21st, the U.S. Catholic bishops launched a national Catholic campaign to end the use of the death penalty. I'd like to just read a few remarks that synthesize Catholic teaching on the death penalty. In January of 1999, Pope John Paul II appeared in St. Louis. And during a homily at that Mass, Pope John Paul II stated, "The new evangelization calls for followers of Christ who are unconditionally pro-life, who will proclaim, celebrate, and serve the gospel of life in every situation. A sign of hope is the increasing recognition that the dignity of human life must never be taken away, even in the case of someone who has done great evil. Modern society has the means of protecting itself without definitively denying criminals the chance to reform. I renew the appeal I made most recently at Christmas for a consensus to end the death penalty, which is both cruel and unnecessary." And on March 21st, in Washington, D.C., Cardinal McCarrick of Washington, D.C., made this statement. "For us, ending the use of the death penalty is not simply about politics, it is about our faith. We believe human life is a gift from God that is not ours to take away. Our faith commits us to the life and dignity of every human person. First, the victims of violent crimes and their families who deserve our help and protection. And today we will hear from a victim's father, Bud Welch. His daughter was killed in the Oklahoma City bombings. Our Catholic teaching on the death penalty is both clear and complicated. The Catholic Church has long acknowledged the right of the state to use the death penalty in order to protect society. However, the Church has more and more clearly insisted the state should forego this right if this has other means to protect society. Pope John Paul II, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the Vatican Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church, and statements from the U.S. bishops are all clear and consistent that the use of the death penalty ought to be abandoned in our nation because we have alternative ways to protect society. For us, this is not about ideology, but respect for life. We cannot teach that killing is wrong by killing. We cannot defend life by taking life. In his encyclical, The Gospel of Life, the Holy Father challenges followers of Christ to be unconditionally pro-life. He reminds us that the dignity of human life must never be taken away, even in the case of someone who has done great evil. As we did in the testimony that we submitted to you earlier on House Bill 2020, the Oregon Catholic Conference reiterates its request and plea to the Oregon Legislative Assembly and to the people of Oregon to abolish the death penalty. We don't need it. It does us greater harm than we think we're trying to achieve. It's time for the death penalty to come to an end in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. And Chair Barker, if I may add, I neglected to mention that the ACLU couldn't be present for this hearing and ask that I state for the record their opposition also to any expansion of the death penalty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else testify in this bill? Close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3037.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3037 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Okay.
I'll carry that. Okay. Is your
Team Westman? I don't.
Yeah. No, Representative Wissenant is not here.
Okay.
Go back up there. Open a work session on House Bill 2136.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have in your materials the dash one amendments. These amendments were the amendments requested by the proponents at our March 1st hearing. In addition, you may recall that we discussed with the proponents of this bill the creation of the new crime, and that's on page 14 of the bill up in section 27. What they have done is just deleted that section in its entirety, and they are essentially reverting back to the existing ORS 399.155.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion to move dash one amendments to House Bill 2136.
Are there any objections? Amendments are entered, so ordered.
Okay, therefore, I would also move then House Bill 2136 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bolton?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative Olson Carey. Okay, let's see if we have any.
We have 2832.
Okay. Close the public hearing on 2136. Open the public hearing on 2833.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have two sets of amendments on House Bill 2833. You may recall this bill, we had a hearing on March 31st. It would continue and modify the authority of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee to allow the use of crime prevention funds for younger children. The only county that wants to still do that essentially is Deschutes County. Therefore, the Dash 2 amendments make that portion of the bill eligible for Deschutes County, Deschutes County only, and that then removes the opponents, that the opposition to the bill then is taken care of. As for the Dash 1 amendments, this is essentially a technical change to the juvenile code, a housekeeping provision that the proponents were just looking for a good bill to stuff this in. It simply takes the definition of counselor and adds to it a juvenile probation officer as well as juvenile department counselor. There is someone here from parole and probation if you have any questions, but essentially the individuals often fulfill a similar purpose, and so it's really a housekeeping issue.
Okay, thank you. And this came about, this is where they can use crime prevention funds for younger kids. And we originally allowed an option for the counties to do that. Some of the counties objected because they were afraid that they would be pressured to do that by their constituents, and they didn't want to have that come up. So we were just doing this essentially for Deschutes County. With that.
Mr. Chair, can I move both? I move the Dash 1 and 2 amendments into House Bill 2833.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2833 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. House Bill 2833 moved to the full committee with a due pass. Representative Thatcher, Chair, please. Yeah. Did we move?
That's the next week.
Okay. Line up. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3471. Representative Wisson.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Barker. Members of the committee.
Testimony copies.
I can provide written testimony or copies of my testimony. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on this bill. I'm really embarrassed to have to introduce this bill because it relates to bad people, and we do have bad people. I want to talk to you about an event happened in my backyard. Greg Brown served as Deschutes County Sheriff from 1996 to 2000, during which time he was once voted Oregon Sheriff of the Year. But during the time that he was sheriff, he stole over $575,000 in taxpayers' money. $171,000 from Deschutes County, $403,000 from Sisters Camp Sherman Fire and Police Division District. According to the Ben Bulletin, the money was funneled to personal banking accounts in Oregon, Delaware, and to his sister's based business. At the time of the sentencing, Greg Brown repaid all the money he had stolen. In 2000, he pleaded guilty to three federal felonies, one state felony. The federal program fraud, money laundering, interstate transfer of stolen property, theft in the first degree. He was sentenced to 33 months in federal prison for his federal convictions and has served his three-month state prison term concurrently. Greg Brown is scheduled for release on September 16, 2005. Despite this behavior, while holding an important position of public trust, he will still collect his employee retirement benefits, which are comprised of substantial public contributions. That Mr. Brown or any other employee should be allowed to defraud the public during his employment and then also enjoy the benefit of additional funds during retirement is the height of physical and social irresponsibility. But current law facilitates such behavior and allows convicted felons to effectively triple dip by committing costly crimes while being paid for their in their position and accumulate retirement contributions. Mr. Chairman and members, all these things led me to introduce House Bill 3471, which allowed the courts to impose a fine if the worker's crime was committed while he was working or was able to commit the crime because of his position. This bill now refers to any person convicted of a felony related to the performance of a person's employment, a state legislator, a teacher, a CEO of a major company, or employee of Nike. The decision to take part of the employee's retirement benefit will be part of a judgment by the courts. And the amount of benefit subject to the fine is 25% or more of an individual's retirement benefits. This is the same amount that can be captured for child support in accordance with ORS 238.445. I am sad to report that this bill will not affect Sheriff Greg Brown. And for your information, the states of Connecticut, Massachusetts, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Florida require forfeiture of public employees' retirement benefits for felony convictions related to employment. This proposed bill has been coordinated with the Department of Justice and the PERS board officials. I served in the military for over 27 years and was subject to double jeopardy. If a military officer breaks the law off the military facility, the officer is subject to Uniform Court of Military Justice. Today, the military has the highest confidence of trust and respect of the public, according to reports I've read. I kindly ask for your approval of this bill with a due pass recommendation to the Judiciary Committee and the House to help me restore the trust and confidence of elected officials, public employees, and also other employees in our community. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. I'm thinking of a case. There was a state police commander who was using his position to manipulate things. He ended up being indicted and convicted, and it was really an embarrassment, I think, to the Oregon State Police and all the people that worked there. Because of that department, since its inception, it's really prided itself on having great integrity. And here you have one guy do that, and he was able to walk away with probation and his full pension.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you for those comments. Okay. Again, I hope that we never have to exercise this bill. But I think it provides confidence to the public and the people out there that we have that ability for someone to be able to steal from you while he's working for you and getting paid for you, and then to get the benefits of retirement does not seem fair and right.
Here, a question.
I actually have had that situation occur, as I've had an employee steal from me quite a bit, and she's in prison now. But she's also going to be collecting her retirement that we were funding. Where would this money go?
If it's a state government, it would go back into the general fund. It would be part of the crime. It's part of the crimes or the fines and penalties is the way we've done this. My initial bill had the PERS board taking the money out and putting it back in the PERS system, but we've changed the bill now. That's not just PERS employees or state employees. It's anyone. And so, the key thing, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, forgot my courtesies. The money now is going to be decided by the judge. The judge, when he finds a person guilty, he is made aware that that individual has a retirement plan or some sort of benefits, and that was involved and, related to his crime. And the judge then will have to take at least 25% or more of his retirement plan.
Mr. Chair, I guess this is interesting. I'm trying to focus on the mechanics. And are we going to hear from Steve Delaney here later? I see him in the audience.
I don't have anybody else signed up.
Okay, so this is my opportunity to get at the technical issues. Is it Steve? Representative Wisdom, I'm trying to understand how we square this with a sort of broad principle of retirement plans, which is that they're subject to a spendthrift clause, and it's a requirement of federal tax law that the interest of an employee in a retirement fund is not subject to execution by any creditor. And I'm wondering if this law avoids that problem by, in effect, fining the recipient rather than attaching their pension. Is that the mechanic of it, the process that we're using?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the representative and I are recalling that in meetings with David Hendricks for Legislative Council that he took that into consideration, and as he put this language together, at least from his research, he seemed to indicate that this was acceptable language. I'm not the expert on that one to respond to.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that was an issue, and I don't know if I have the complete folder, but that was an issue that we were concerned about, and we were advised by Legislative Council that we're okay on that.
Okay. Just, if I might, Mr. Chair, just get more by way of dialogue than it is really a question. The issue is, I think, whether you can what the collection process is. That is, as a matter of federal law, we could not say that this, in order to preserve the tax benefits of the PERS system and of private retirement plans that an official is covered by as well, we couldn't preserve their favorable tax treatment if we provided for a forfeiture of the benefit itself, because that's a protected right under federal tax law. So I think what's going on here is we're saying that you still get your benefit, but you owe a fine at the same time. And I think one of the issues is just how you collect that fine then. Is there a way of intercepting it before it comes into the hands of the criminal? And this may work, but I just raise it as a technical question. I mean, I'm fine with the purpose that we're trying to carry out. It's just a question of whether we can get there from here with this language.
And can you identify yourself, please, too, for the record?
My apologies. Yes, for the record, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of PERS. Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. Yes, what this is saying is it's opening up a part of that benefit to execution, similar to, as was mentioned, the executionable portion of the benefit for child support, where PERS will, if directed by a court, to make a payment from the person's benefit to another party. We will do that. Again, right now it's with child support. This expands that to this particular case where a court has said because of this felony there would be this diversion of the benefit. But you're absolutely right that we still retain within our statute the directive that we're to do nothing that would imperil the tax qualification of the fund, and we're always looking to those issues and have that continual review of our plan, for instance, by the Internal Revenue Service to verify that we haven't taken on an action or activity that would imperil the tax qualification of the plan.
Follow up if I might. And is there an automatic provision elsewhere in the ORS that would nullify this bill if we were to enact it automatically if it had that impact on tax qualification?
Yes. Chair Barker, Representative McPherson. It's in the 600 series, 238, 600 series. There are specific statute. I can't find it immediately, but specific language. It says the PERS board may take whatever action necessary to ensure the tax qualification of the fund. So we've always read that to be, in essence, sort of a trump of anything the legislature may do, and because the legislature, in essence, has told us, don't let us inadvertently disqualify your plan.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to also compliment the PERS board for working with me. I didn't get everything I wanted with this bill, but I think it's a good bill that's going to reflect good upon state employees and elected officials. So.
Thank you. Well, I think the PERS board had quite a hurdle to overcome there just to work on that, because it is, Representative McPherson said, those pensions are really protected and for good reason, but they weren't thinking about criminals. I mean, they're thinking about unscrupulous. I think it was more guided towards unscrupulous employers that they're trying to protect their retirees from, but would be my take on that. Anyway, okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, what will this have a chance then to come before the full committee? Will you like?
We'll find out in just a minute.
Okay.
Well, anxious, isn't he?
close the public hearing on 3470 and open a work session on House Bill 3471.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3471 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Move the full committee with a due pass. Representative McPherson, carry, please. Ian, is there any further business before the subcommittee this morning? Hearing none, adjourned.
Question.